This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. GLT looks back at the year since prosecutors filed criminal charges against former managers of the Bloomington Coliseum, and a comment from Mayor Terry Renner that could get the trial moved out of McLean County.
I have made it clear in the past that trying to deal with Siam was like trying to deal with a Soviet gulag.
Where the Coliseum theft case stands now, plus the winners and losers in the shifting Illinois Public University enrollment landscape. Illinois Attorney General candidate Kwame Raoul gives voters his case in GLT's effort to bring you some stump speeches. And Bloomington native Jenny B. releases her folky debut album, John Norton Reports. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It's been a year since five former Coliseum officials were charged with 111 criminal counts accused of running a brazen multi-year fraud scheme that stole hundreds of thousands of dollars from Bloomington taxpayers. In the 353 days since those indictments were unsealed, none of those five cases have been resolved. No one has been convicted or cleared. None of the cases appear close to a trial. And yet, that's not a total surprise, given the complexity of the case. GLT's Ryan Denham has been following the case. He's here to update it. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Sure thing.
Let's do a quick refresher. Who was charged?
So John Butler was the lead defendant. He's the owner of Central Illinois Arena Management, which ran the city's Coliseum from 2006 to 2016. That's like the first decade of its existence. He faced 44 counts, the most of anyone. Charged alongside him, though, were former Coliseum general manager Bart Rogers, former assistant GM for finance Kelly Klein, former concessions GM Paul Grazier, and former concessions finance chief Jay Lash. So their indictments a year ago capped this long 16-month Illinois State Police investigation that began in 2016. That was after John Butler's company left and a new company took over, and they noticed financial discrepancies basically and alerted the city. So for years before that, auditors had repeatedly warned city leaders about their contract with Butler and saying it was riddled with ambiguity, needed to be reworked, and several of those issues that were flagged are now part of this criminal case.
What are those issues? What are they accused of?
The original bills of indictment were kind of light on details, and that's actually been used by defense attorneys to try to get the charges dismissed. But some details have trickled out in the past year, namely through this related civil lawsuit between the city and Butler. In a nutshell, though, prosecutors and city officials allege that Butler and some combination of the other four defendants skimmed hundreds of thousands of dollars in concession fees that should have been paid to the city from the Coliseum. So an example of that would be Butler's company was required to pay the city between a 32 and 42% commission on food and beverage sales at the arena. So when you go to buy a beer or a pretzel, the city was going to get a smaller cut, just 15% for when you bought a beer in a suite, for example, so a little bit of a different percentage. So the city has claimed that Butler's company deliberately misclassified sales as coming from that cheaper section where the commission would be smaller, even though it didn't.
What do the defendants say?
In short, that they're not guilty. Butler's attorneys have argued that the authorities improperly took a civil contract dispute between Butler and the city of Bloomington into criminal court, and their attempts to dismiss the case so far have yielded mixed results. Last month, a judge dismissed 14 of those 44 counts against Butler, but prosecutors say they intend to reindict on some of those charges soon, fixing some statute of limitations issues that were present. Also last month, during a hearing, Two defense attempts to kill the case against Butler were dismissed by a judge, and a third motion to dismiss remains pending. Other defendants have also tried to get their cases dismissed. Bart Rogers, the former general manager of the arena, has actually done that twice successfully. A judge ruled that the indictments against him were too vague and did not fall within the statute of limitations, and he only faces at this point one pending theft charge, and that's down from 13 originally a year ago. Also earlier this year, Paul Grazier, he's that former concessions general manager, was in negotiations with prosecutors to resolve the charges against him in some fashion. But those negotiations ended or broke down. His attorney filed a motion to dismiss as well. And, you know, he again is citing the vagueness of the original charges and statute of limitations issues.
Was that an attempt to flip him?
We don't really know. We don't really know. All we've been told is potential negotiations to resolve. No more than that.
Why haven't the cases moved more quickly toward trial?
Well, this is a bit of speculation, but one obvious thing to think about is how incredibly complex these cases are, particularly the one against Butler. The case has generated thousands and thousands of documents, and Butler's attorneys have been fighting to get access to like 70 boxes, more than 70 boxes of business records that were seized by investigators. They're still fighting to get access to those and search warrant documents, you know, that were issued to local businesses that had some ties to the arena. Another factor here, though, is possibly, you know, the prosecutorial and judicial churn on the case. Jason Chambers was the McLean County State's attorney a year ago when the charges were filed. A guy named Adam Grist was his chief deputy, his first assistant. Chambers has since left that job to become a judge, and Adam Grist has left his job to become a federal prosecutor. So the lead prosecutor in the Coliseum case is now Brad Rigdon, working under the new state's attorney, Don Knapp. So I spoke to Don Knapp a couple of days ago, and he told me that, quote, neither Jason nor Adam operated in a vacuum when moving forward in the Coliseum cases. He said that Brad Rigdon was intimately involved with the charging initially and handling of the case since its inception, and that Brad has his complete confidence. One other thing to think about, too, is that, you know, judges change. So Judge Bill Yoder took over the Butler case from Judge Robert Freitag, who retired in July. So, you know, certainly some time needed to get up to speed there, too.
Sometimes defendants' attorneys say, I really want this to move fast toward trial. Other times they drag their heels. What are the defendants saying about how long it's taking to advance this case?
At least one of the defense lawyers is saying that those changes in the state's attorney's office is slowing things down a little bit. Joel Brown represents Kelly Klein. She's one of the five defendants. He says that she is innocent, and they've engaged in some discussions with prosecutors about resolving the 12 counts against her, though he stresses that that doesn't mean there's not going to be a guilty plea is what he says. So because of those discussions and, you know, staff changes in the state's attorney's office, Joel Brown says he's held off on filing his own motions to dismiss like some of the other defendants have done. But he says that prosecutors are going to have to decide at some point here what to do with her case, or he is going to essentially start filing those motions to dismiss, putting him on the same track as the other defendants. Don Knapp told me that he doesn't think that turnover on the bench or in the state's attorney's office has had much of an impact at all regarding the pace at which the matter has proceeded.
What would a trial look like?
Well, first thing is it might not even be in McLean County, at least for John Butler. Butler's defense team has asked for a change of venue. They argue that the case has been so sensationalized in the local media that that it'd be nearly impossible to get a juror in McLean County who hasn't already like been exposed to a lot of information about the case and untrue stuff about Butler, as they put it. GLT's own reporting was referenced in this motion to change the venue, including this October 27 interview with Mayor Terry Renner. I'm going to play you a clip.
I have made it clear in the past that trying to deal with Siam was like trying to deal with a Soviet gulag.
So, you know, any references to a Soviet gulag is probably going to come up as you are thinking about what venue to hold the trial.
Inflammatory much?
Oh, yeah, that's the argument. Butler hired a jury consulting firm to survey a couple hundred McLean County residents. And this is what they gave to the judge. They found that survey reportedly found 26% of those who already knew about the Coliseum case thought Butler was probably or definitely guilty. And that's coming from the defense.
Is that high enough to our successfully get a change in the location of the trial?
That's what we should find out here in a few months, so when the judge makes his ruling.
So what about the lawsuit, the one between Butler and the city?
So that's moving on a separate but parallel track. So Butler and the city of Bloomington have been tied up in ongoing civil litigation about all this stuff. Butler actually sued the city first, claiming that he was owed like $67,000 in unpaid commissions. That was right after he was criminally charged. A few months later, the city countersues Butler, says that he breached his contract and all sorts of other stuff. That civil lawsuit is where city officials have spelled out publicly the greatest details about the scheme because, again, the indictments themselves were a little light on details. So some of the most dramatic accusations that have come out of this is allegedly an internal secret document that was used to track phony commissions. The city is claiming that Butler used money from the Coliseum's fund, which was meant for like operating expenses, to pay his own attorneys. So if that was true, it would mean the city was unknowingly paying a lawyer to negotiate against itself. Another one that was sort of interesting is that the city also claimed Butler's company was effectively billing the city to rent its own cleaning equipment. Again, I'll caution here that Butler has pleaded not guilty to the criminal charges upon which these allegations are, you know, resting upon.
You mentioned that the civil countersuit by the city against Butler accuses Butler of violating the contract, which is one of the defense arguments in the criminal case, that this is not a criminal matter, it's a contract dispute. Does that allow the defense in the criminal case to reference the civil case saying, hey, the city's even calling it a contract dispute?
Possibly. I think the contract is really going to be a central part of this whole thing if it gets to trial. There's just a lot of fuzziness with it, and fuzziness that the city of Bloomington was well aware of in the years leading up to the criminal charges.
That's GLT's Ryan Denham, who's been following the Coliseum fraud case for the past year. The criminal cases against all five defendants remain pending. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Luther Oaks, helping ease seniors' transition to retirement living with caring, compassionate move management and relocation services. They understand and address the unique needs of people making this significant life change. Details at lutheroaks.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, Illinois Attorney General candidate Kwame Raoul gives us his stump speech. U.S. health officials say teenage use of e-cigarettes has reached epidemic levels and are calling on the industry to address the problem or risk having their flavored products pulled off the market. The warning this week from the Food and Drug Administration marks a stark shift in the agency's tone on e-cigarettes, which have become the most used tobacco product among teenagers. Since 2017, FDA officials have discussed e-cigarettes as a potential tool to wean adult smokers off cigarettes, but FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb says the agency did not predict an epidemic of addiction among youth, mainly driven by flavored products. Gottlieb says the five largest e-cigarette manufacturers have 2 months to produce plans to immediately reverse underage use of their products. Earlier this year, GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds penetrated the haze obscuring vaping's growth. Here is a portion of that report again about products with names like cotton candy and cookies and cream.
Hey vapers, Abby here, and it's the video you've all been waiting for. How to blow smoke rings. Today we are vaping on Alpha Vapes, the dude, because I'm obsessed with it, and it is a pineapple peach, and it is awesome.
If you think videos like what you just heard and others like it on YouTube are not having an impact, consider Ian Hoganson, a 16-year-old Bloomington High School student.
It all just kind of started probably like freshman year. I'll be going into junior when those big vape mods were a cool thing and all the smoke tricks and whatnot. Kind of no nicotine, just kind of like with the O's and whatnot. Just kind of to mess around with, nothing really harmful.
Hoganson admits he was enamored by the wafting smoke rings on those videos, but because of his self-admitted addictive tendencies, he was also sucked in for another reason.
Now it's kind of just moved on to more of the nicotine buzz with like the Juuls and whatnot. I have kind of like sparked popularity in sophomore year. It's kind of just what I use these days.
Hoganson is not alone.
Teens are more likely, some of the research right now suggests that 4 times more likely to walk into a cigarette habit.
That's Liz Hamilton, community program coordinator for Bloomington-based Chestnut Health Systems, well-respected respected globally in the addiction treatment field. Hamilton says the Illinois Youth Survey from this spring, an anonymous survey of 8th, 10th, and 12th graders, showed 26% of Central Illinois high school seniors and 15% of sophomores are using e-cigarettes. That's double from just 2 years ago when the state first started tracking use. Vaporizing devices come in all shapes and sizes, from custom-built bong-like devices that can blow plumes of billowing vapor to the tiniest that look like a USB drive, with the top seller referred to as a Juul, by far the most popular among teens. According to Hamilton, Juuls can deliver up to 4 times as much nicotine as a traditional cigarette, so addiction occurs faster. And she says research shows teens have no idea what they're taking in.
I've seen some recent research that suggests that 63% of the Juul users are unaware that there is nicotine in their product.
In fact, that same recent youth survey showed only about a quarter of high school students perceived vaping as harmful. Remember our 16-year-old BHS student, Ian Hoganson? He's become addicted to nicotine, but he says other kids don't seem to know or care what they're vaping.
It's crazy how all these trending devices like a Juul can actually get kids addicted to nicotine, and they don't even really notice it. They don't even really think it's a big deal. And I don't know if they know like the true definition of being an addict, but that's what a lot of these kids are becoming at my school.
Hoganson wishes he never started vaping, and he has a message for his 14-year-old brother Sam and other younger students.
You're not missing out on a lot in the way your brain's developing. I mean, I sound like a mom, but it's really not good to get into.
Hoganson not only sounds like his mother, he sounds like the head of the Federal Drug Administration, who recently pointed out nicotine in vaping products can rewire an adolescent's brain, leading to years of addiction. Chestnut Health Systems Hamilton says most addictions do have roots in the teen years, and she argues vaping is a gateway to other tobacco use.
Teens are more likely, some of the research right now suggests that 4 times more likely to walk into a cigarette habit.
23-year-old college student Kyle Fitzgerald already had a cigarette habit by age 15. Growing up in suburban Chicago Heights, he found nicotine helped with stress and anxiety he felt in high school.
After about 3 months, you're kind of addicted to cigarettes and you like that buzz and that feeling in your head. So I was looking for something that I could do where I wouldn't get in trouble, because my mom has the nose of a bloodhound.
At age 16, Kyle found his answer in the form of a vape pen that his stepfather began using to kick his addiction to chewing tobacco.
So I would go into his room and I'd take his little vape pen and I'd use it. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. This is awesome. I want my own, because he always knew when I'd use it. So I went out and I got a couple friends together, and I found one of my friends who was 18, and we went to Indiana, where it's cheap and really accessible.
At age 17, Fitzgerald's mom found his Sherlock Holmes-style vaporizing pipe and threw it out. He returned to cigarettes because he says he could no longer invest in vaping supplies.
I think it was like $45 for just one of the smaller, like 60-milliliter bottles. That would last me probably like a week and a half. Yeah.
Now, Fitzgerald is back to vaping because today's smaller devices are cheaper. Online, they go for as low as $10, including one cartridge of vape juice, and they're easier to get. Hoganson told us it's been easy to get supplies from what he describes as sketchy gas stations.
Just kind of crazy how a 13-year-old kid could walk into a gas station and get whatever they want. No IDs or whatnot.
Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner says his agency hasn't specifically tracked violations of sales of vaping products to anyone under 18, but he plans in the future to separate out tobacco and vaping-related violations due to what appears to be, in his words, a growing problem. To date, he's not aware of any vaping sale violations. Bloomington Police Public Information Officer Elias Mendiola says he didn't have access to information about tobacco or vaping sale violations readily available, but added he's not sure the metrics will, as he put it, show anything significant.
Yeah, it's been a problem of people doing it right out in the open.
That's Bloomington High School Assistant Principal Michael Shanley, who says because students are able to use such small devices, vaping violators are getting pretty bold about sneaking ahead.
So we've had a couple instances of students doing it in the classroom. Mostly it's been in bathrooms. It's been reported students doing it in their car in the parking lot. We have had instances of a kid doing it in the cafeteria.
One enterprising company has developed a smartphone app that connects to a system to detect vapor from e-cigs. Shanley says no such drastic measures at Bloomington High School yet, but with a population of 1,500 students, the school saw 14 violations for tobacco this school year, and all were vaping-related, compared to 2 disciplinary actions against students caught vaping last school year. Shanley admits administrators were caught off guard about how fast use is growing.
We're seeing it across all demographics. We're seeing it across all socioeconomic status. You know, it's a lot of, I'm seeing a lot of different types of kids who get caught for this. It's not just one group.
In Unit 5, Normal Community High School principal Trevor Chapman says there were 28 tobacco violations among more than 2,150 students this year, and all but 2 were vaping related. Someone who says he's in better health today because of vaping won't debate the science, but shares his personal positive experience of switching from cigarettes to vaping. Chris Hyatt, a 30-year-old Normal Community West High School grad, started his Liquid Temptations vaping juice business 4 years ago at a time when he weighed nearly 300 pounds and felt like he was having a heart attack. He quit smoking, started vaping, and now Hyatt is a mixologist of sorts, creating vaping liquid for handheld mods and larger devices. Hyatt has perfected concoctions with names such as Crunch Cake and Uproar, described as a grape frozen sorbet taste. He supplies several of Bloomington Normal's 13 stores specifically selling tobacco and vaping products. He makes some juices without any nicotine and says he limits nicotine content to no more than 6 milligrams in a 60-milliliter bottle. For reference, one cigarette has between 8 and 20 milligrams. Like many advocates, Hyatt comes from the position of reducing harm, but he's not ready to definitely claim vaping is healthier than smoking. However, Hyatt says he feels better.
I quit smoking, like, oh my God, I was able to start eating better, start exercising. I run miles now where I couldn't run a half mile before. So it's definitely helped change my life for the better and a lot of other people I know.
Hyatt counts his own mother, a smoker for decades, as one of his success stories. However, federal regulators say there is not enough evidence using e-cigarettes are an effective way to stop smoking. And so far, no vaping or e-cigarette companies have applied for FDA approval for smoking cessation use. Still, Chris Hyatt says his home base of the Smoker's Den in downtown Bloomington sees a lot of elderly patients who were longtime smokers who have now started vaping. After a few months, he says, they come in unassisted instead of using walkers. But aren't they just transferring one addiction to another?
They will come in and they will get an e-cig set up and they will vape it. And once their nicotine's dropped from a higher level to a lower level, they're done with it altogether.
Hyatt understands the argument that vaping could be creating a new generation of addicts, but he insists his business doesn't market to kids and that his higher price point at $200 or more for a device acts as a deterrent. Still, Hyatt, who has 2 small children, would be okay with some additional regulation.
The label's not catering towards children. You know, we did our best to build a brand to where it's definitely more adult geared. We're okay with the warning label being on the bottle. We don't care that it takes up promotional space for our company.
Hyatt opposes raising the age for sale of vaping products to 21. He says that'll only drive younger customers to the black market and to neighboring states. 25 Illinois cities, including Peoria and Chicago, have already restricted sale of tobacco and vaping products to adults 21 and older. I'm Colleen Reynolds.
In late August, Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner vetoed legislation that would have restricted sales of vaping equipment to products and products to those under 21 statewide. The governor cited the loss of sales tax revenue to the state. Rauner said raising the minimum age to buy tobacco from 18 would push residents to buy tobacco products from non-licensed vendors or in neighboring states.
Support for GLT comes from CEFQ, partnering with car dealers throughout central Illinois to make the auto loan process quick and convenient. Competitive rates for qualified buyers, online pre-approval is available. CEFQ, not a bank, better. Details at CEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, John Norton introduces us to musician Jenny B., a folky sound with opera and classical training. After 2 decades as a prosecutor, State Senator Kwame Raoul is running for Illinois Attorney General against Republican candidate Erica Harold. GLT is bringing you stump speeches from some of the top ticket candidates in Illinois. Speaking in Normal at an agriculture legislative roundtable event, Raoul stressed the importance of uniting all parts of the state, city, suburban, and rural. A self-described kid from Chicago, Raoul makes his pitch why he's a good option to serve as Illinois Attorney General.
Obviously, as been described, I'm a kid from Chicago, right? From the south side of Chicago. And, you know, I realized from the moment that I was appointed, I was actually appointed November 6th is a special day for me, not only because the election this year is on November 6th, but 14 years ago was the day that I was appointed to replace Barack Obama in his state Senate seat on November 6th, which was just 2 days before the beginning of veto session. So that November 6th appointment was a Saturday up in Chicago, and 2 days later I was stepping up into the state capitol, and I gotta be honest with you, that was my first time in the state capitol. So I didn't enter the state capitol as a elementary student visiting the capitol. I walked in the state capitol the first time, a state senator, and I had an office in the building, so that was kind of neat. Barack Obama was there on that day, and he was there to say goodbye to his colleagues, and I tapped him on the shoulder, and I said, you know what, I acknowledged to him that, you know, this is my first time in this building. Might you give me a little bit of advice as to how I tackle this job before I get started, because we were going to start considering matters on that very day. He says, well, you know, I got to take off to D.C., but I'm going to have a lunch in my office. Why don't you follow me in there, and I could talk to you while I'm having lunch. I said, that's cool and everything, but isn't that my office now? He said, come on, Kwame. He did give me a piece of advice, though, in all seriousness, on that day that I took very seriously, and I've applied for the last 14 years in my time in the legislature. He says, you know, Kwame, I know you know some folks down here already, primarily folks who come from Chicago. You can spend all your time hanging around people from Chicago who think exactly like you, or you could get to know people from other regions of the state, get to know people on the other side of the aisle. I took that advice seriously. And that has that piece of advice that I got on that very first day has been very beneficial for me over the course of the last 14 years that I've served as a policymaker. Because if anybody's noticed, we've had some difficult policy issues in Springfield over the course of the last 14 years. And during my tenure as a state senator, I haven't run from any of them. I've run towards them. Whether it was workers' compensation reform, negotiation of concealed carry, it would have been easy for a Chicago legislator to say, oh, this concealed carry thing, I'm going to run as far away from that negotiation as possible. Because for me, politically, back in my district, it wouldn't have been any benefit for me to be engaged in that. But I had actually approached the Senate president a few years before and said, I think we should tackle this. We're the 50th, we're the only state that hasn't done it yet. I think it's time we tackle this and let's negotiate it. And that was before the court had mandated that we do something about it. And so I was at the very center of that debate. I think we negotiated a decent package, you know, but as I said, I've run towards difficult legislation. The old Senate president used to call it middle of the highway legislation. Because what happens is you get hit traffic going by traffic going both directions. And I did so with workers' comp. I've done so with various issues because I think that's what leadership calls upon. It's not just about stepping up when it's the easy stuff. It's about stepping up to stuff that, you know, you're going to have to compromise. It's stuff that everybody's going to be a little bit upset with you. Sometimes when everybody's a little bit upset with you, you know, you have a decent product because we've got a diverse legislature with people coming from all parts of the state. Another way that I followed that advice that I got on the first day is my relationship with the Farm Bureau over the course of the last 14 years. I was one of the legislators that was invited to participate in and adopt a legislator process, program, and Jefferson County was the county that adopted me, and I and my family went down to Jefferson County, and I was so impressed with the experience that I approached the Farm Bureau, and I said, it's not good enough for just me and my family to have this experience. I said, I gotta bring a busload of folks up from Chicago down to Jefferson County so that they can have that experience. And so we did just that. We put together, in partnership with the Farm Bureau, a rural-urban exchange, we called it. And we had high school students, college students, we had teachers, law enforcement officers, people from chambers of commerce. We filled up a busload of 50 people. We did 3 days, 2 nights. We visited the farms. We visited the different businesses in the area, the healthcare facilities, the jail. And then, 2 weeks later, we filled a busload of 50 people from Jefferson County, and we brought them up to the city. And we visited the jail. we visited various high schools. The community colleges. Then we brought all 100 people, all 100 together, and we had a televised town hall meeting to discuss differences and commonalities and how together we can tackle the problems of the state. You know, I don't think we do enough of that. I think we need to do a whole lot more of that. I, in my experience as a legislator, know that I've been imperfect, right? But I try to learn from experiences from other people that I have not had. And that's, I've tried to do my best in that process. I'm a kid of Haitian immigrants who came here in the 50s. My father was a physician. He was an old-fashioned house call doc. He had a little black bag, stethoscope, medicine, and a little black pistol in there because he used to make house calls at all times of the night and all types of neighborhoods in the city. He would come home with a fruitcake, a block of cheese sometimes, because he would never reject a patient because of their inability to pay. I told you November 6th was a special day for me because I was appointed 14 years ago and it's election day this year. But 15 years ago was the day I lost my dad to prostate cancer. It was the same disease that took his father and my mother's father. So I know, you know, when you go to the doc, what do they ask you about? They ask you about family history. And I was, for a number of years, I was able to answer that question. Yeah, I've got a family history of prostate cancer. So we would screen. And 3 years ago, my day came. First business day of the year, I get a phone call. I guess I sort of won. get the call, you know, you came back positive for prostate cancer. But I had been screening every year, screening, blessed with the warning of my family and blessed with access to health care. And because I'd been screening, I was a beneficiary of early detection. And because I had that access to health care, I was able to question, find out. I interviewed several surgeons, and I was able to find the guy who had done the most robotic prostatectomies in the area. I said, okay, you're the winner. You're my guy. You're going to do it. And it was right in the middle of the session. I had surgery, and my access to health care allowed for me to get back to work about a couple of weeks after my surgery. I was right back in Springfield recovering, and the recovery wasn't fun, but I was back there doing my work. I mentioned this because one of my important priorities, both as a legislator and hopefully as your next attorney general, is to fight for that same access to health care, not just for me because I got a great job, you know, but for everybody. You know, prostate cancer is one of these diseases that, you know, it's probably one of the top, if not the top, cancer amongst men. You know, if you live long enough, you're probably going to get it. But it's also a very curable one if you have access to the healthcare. So I don't believe anybody should be denied that access. I don't think anybody should be denied the opportunity to have their life saved like me. And so that's certainly going to be a priority for me. It was mentioned earlier that I started my career as a prosecutor up in Cook County, and one of the during my tenure in the state's attorney's office, I served in the Child Protection Division. And that means I prosecuted child abuse and neglect. And it's an experience that if you go through day-to-day serving in that office and you see the types of cases that come in, it's horrific. But it's something that we have to turn our attention to. One of the things that in this process of running for Attorney General, I learned that the Attorney General's office has responsibility for the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. You know that kids are walking around with cell phones and tablets, and they're on computers at younger and younger ages. And I don't know if I'm a parent. I don't know how many of you all have been parents, but I know that I wasn't watching my kids at every moment they were on a computer, every moment they were on a cell phone, and I haven't watched them in the chat rooms that they've been in. But some other people are. There's some child predators who are watching them in those chat rooms. And an important priority for me is to make sure we keep up with the technology in our effort to protect our kids, because we have to protect. You know, I don't know if you followed the news about the Catholic Church in Pennsylvania. Josh Shapiro is a friend of mine who's the Attorney General of Pennsylvania, just released the grand jury report that talked about a very disturbing trend in Pennsylvania. We have to prioritize protecting, most of all, anybody, our kids throughout the state. And that means that law enforcement throughout the state should be equipped with the tools to protect them, because it's a different terrain now. It used to be if they're under your roof and they're within your vision, you know they're safe. Not anymore, because of this technology that we have today. So that's definitely a priority. Public corruption is something that is talked about a lot in our state. We've sent more than our share of governors to the federal penitentiary, so necessarily it's talked about. I agree with Justice Brandeis. Justice Brandeis said that the number one cleanser to public corruption is sunshine, that nobody's going to be doing anything if you're watching. That's why I sponsored legislation to create the public access counselor within the Attorney General's office. That did not exist until I introduced and passed that legislation, to make sure that FOIA requests and FOIA challenges and Open Meeting Act complaints are processed by the Attorney General's office. Now, one of my priorities is to make sure that public access counselor's office is appropriately resourced so we can more rapidly get responses to FOIA, complaints on FOIA requests or Open Meeting Acts complaints. Another topic that's been discussed is the notion of whether or not we should extend grand jury authority to the Attorney General's office. I'm certainly open to that, but if we're going to do it, we should make sure the Attorney General's office is appropriately resourced to effectively do the jobs in these cases. But even if the legislature does not do that, right now the Attorney General has the capacity, and I've spoken to attorney generals throughout the state. In fact, this past weekend I was with a few of them, to collaborate, and I've maintained a great relationship with the State's Attorneys Association during my tenure in the legislature, to collaborate with local state's attorneys that know their respective regions the best to go after public corruption. And I know it hasn't been heavily reported, but I asked the attorney general, well, you know, to what extent have you done it? And she gave me a long list of cases where she's prosecuted public officials, including prosecutors, sheriffs, state employees who've committed fraud. But sometimes the discussion doesn't make its way onto the airways. But that prosecution has taken place under the tenure of the current Attorney General. And certainly, if I'm elected your next Attorney General, and any incident of public corruption is brought to my attention, I will vigorously go after it, utilizing the experience I've had as a prosecutor. I've practiced law for 25 years. Beginning as a prosecutor, I've worked on policy for 14 years. I've turned to the Farm Bureau for advice on matters that sometimes that I didn't know, admittedly, much about. I didn't grow up on a farm. I didn't grow up in a rural area. So it's been a learning process for me. One of the controversial issues that I was involved with this past session was a bill that was brought to me with regards to people having standing when there's a permitting issue and they whether or not they're an impacted party. It brought a lot of discussion to my office in Springfield. You know, Jay came to me, said, "Oh no, you can't do this," and in the Farm Bureau and others. And because of the policy that I've had in Springfield, my door was open. My door was open to people to come to educate me on the obstacles they saw with the legislation that we put forth. We tried to amend it, but at the end of the day, you know, I had a conversation with the Farm Bureau and I had a conversation with the folks who brought it to my attention, and we decided not to pursue it. And that is what the legislative process is about. You know, they call it sausage making sometimes because you have different people with different perspectives that weigh in and you listen. I started at the earlier part of my presentation saying I've run towards the controversial issues. One of the benefits of doing that is you talk to different people who have different perspectives. You get them in a room together and you try to work it out. That's who I've been. That's who I will be if I'm elected your next Attorney General.
That's Kwame Raoul, the Democratic candidate for Illinois Attorney General, speaking recently at an Illinois Farm Bureau Agricultural Legislative Roundtable at Raider Farms in Bloomington Normal. Raoul filled the Senate seat left vacant, formerly held by President Barack Obama in 2004, the state Senate seat, rather, and was then elected to Congress, Obama was. Listen to the speech from Raoul's opponent, Erica Harold, coming up on Sound Ideas on Monday. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington native Jenny Bratcher Crafton, a.k.a. Jenny B., has an opera and musical theater background, but due to debilitating health issues, her music career is still in its early stages. Jenny B.'s folky debut album titled Crickets and Honey was recorded on the Schertz Farm outside Saybrook. That's also the venue for her CD release party this Sunday. Jenny B. tells GLT's John Norton she preferred a nighttime outdoor setting for this recording where crickets acted as background accompaniment.
Yes, that they are.
You can hear them. Listen, let's listen to them. You can hear them.
Yeah, they're pretty sweet.
Was this intentional?
Was the setting intentional? Yes. Were the crickets intentional? I guess I kind of knew where we were going, so I guess...
Well, it's a cute little touch.
And then I couldn't figure out what to name it.
And it's not really... It doesn't really distract, either.
No, good.
I don't think it does.
Okay, good, good. I was worried it might, like, by the end of the movie, you'd feel like you were, like, in the birds or something, you know, that constant, like, the locusts or something. No, my grandma was having a hard time naming it, and she said, well, put your headphones on, and what's the first thing you think? And because I was going to name it, like, Raw Honey or something, and the first thing I said, well, the first thing I thought, thinks crickets. I'm like, crickets and honey.
There you go.
And so it just kind of evolved from there. And then if you look up the symbolism of crickets, it's kind of neat. So
the lead song is called The Harder I Fall.
It is, yes.
And to me, this is like another take on what doesn't kill you will make you stronger.
Okay.
The harder I fall, the higher I climb, keep my head up.
The harder I fall, all my music is pretty relevant to like the things I'm going through and the things that I'm challenged with and I'm working on and the human spirit. Really, I used to believe that my successes were what made me. And when I got sick and had to start to rebuild and the journey of healing began, I realized that it really wasn't my successes that were making me. It was my falls that were making me. So that's just kind of a trend I had to learn that was going to be a trend in my life because I fall a lot.
Your songs. I'm going back to what you were saying. Your songs and even your Facebook posts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Often deal with, looks like, obstacles.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Self-affirmation. Even what Google used to be, right? Don't be mean.
I really think that kindness is something that we all need to have a little bit more of.
Where does that come from?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I'm a pretty sweet person.
I mean, that's an obvious thing to do, but it seems to be a real focal part.
Sweet.
Of your songwriting and your...
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah? Oh, gosh.
At least what I'm hearing on this album.
I play with my partner is Andrew Brucker. He's a farmer. He says he grows things, knows things, and plays the mandolin. And he always just says, Jenny, you're sweet as honey. And all your songs are about love. He's like, we jokes around. He's like, Jenny's going to write it. He's like, next album, we're going to write some dirty songs. Jenny's going to sing about not hugging people and smashing flowers. I don't know. I guess I hadn't really thought about it much.
Okay, we'll move ahead to the song called Dive Bombing in Paradise.
Oh, I love that song.
It has a different kind of theme to it. It seems to me like you're in paradise somewhere, maybe on vacation drinking out of a coconut.
Yeah, my husband and I co-wrote the lyrics to that song in Costa Rica. Over a morning, we were out drinking some coffee out on a patio. We'd gone to a friend's wedding and there were these great big birds, and they were in the ocean, and they would go about 50 to 100 feet up in the air, and then they would and splash back down in the water. I mean, they look like the old warplanes, is what it reminded me of. You know, they'd spin down, and they'd come back up with a great big fish in their mouth.
My, oh, my, oh, my, oh, take me higher.
Got an opera background and a musical theater background. When did music itself become an important part of your life? Were you really young?
Well, since you just introduced me, Jenny Bratcher Crafton. Bratcher, my dad. He is a guitar player and he plays out of this world. But I grew up Sunday afternoons. We went to church. We'd come home and everybody'd be playing bluegrass and gospel music after lunch, and then we'd go to nighttime church service. Church and gospel music were probably where I think the first recording we have of me is on like a 8-track singing Happy Birthday, Baby Jesus.
Our guest is Jenny Bratcher Crafton, a.k.a. Jenny B., her new album, and it's a good one, called Crickets and Honey. There's another song that really caught my ear on this album, and it's called Tighten Up Now.
That song actually is about a very good friend of mine.
Is this literal? Should I take this song literally?
How do you take it, John?
I take it as someone who had a real tough time that had a baby and probably shouldn't have had a baby.
Okay.
And then because there was a shotgun wedding, am I reading this into this correctly?
I'm enjoying to hearing your interpretation. Go on.
I'm just going by the lyrics.
Okay.
And this baby didn't really have the opportunity it should have had because it was born in not good circumstances.
Well, you're pretty right on there. My friend Ty was born addicted to drugs. His mama was a drug addict. And one of his first memories he had was his mom overdosing while he was in the high chair. He sat in the high chair for, I think, almost a day and a half until an aunt came and broke in and I think pulled him out of the high chair is how I remember him telling me the story. And Ty was full of love, and he had lots of people that loved him, but he didn't have a very, very, very fair start. He ended up being a heroin addict and unfortunately perished a few years ago on the bathroom floor at the Salvation Army in Bloomington.
Born is a little bitty baby boy too, sad, sad mama son. No, no, she did never think to offer you boy to a loaded gun. Oh, she robbed you of your life while you were up in that high chair. She left you a long way all alone up there.
So many people in the world struggle with addiction, and I've seen so many of my friends make it to the good side, but so many do not, and Ty did not, and they didn't even have a funeral for him. The day that they He told me they weren't having a funeral for him. I sat down on the couch, and that song just kind of came out. And so that song's for Ty. And usually when I play that, if I'm at a party or a festival, it's kind of a good opportunity to, you know, put out a little public service announcement to take care of your friends and watch out for yourself if you party, because that is a part of the music world and part of the world.
These hands clean and dirt in the shadows of those dirty party posies.
Jenny Bratcher Crafton, Jenny B, Crickets and Honey is the name of the album. Well, thanks for coming in.
You make me cry there, John.
I was almost kind of a tear going myself. That's a tough story. Basically, what you're saying is this is your first real album almost.
It is. I tell you, since I sang opera and musical theater and classical music, I never really realized that I had a voice or could write any music. It was just really exciting to all of a sudden, you know, 3-4 years later now, I did this. Like, I felt like that ship sailed far away, and it was sort of a little disappointment to myself and some of the people, like my folks and my dad, that supported me. And so it just proves that don't ever let things go. Yeah, hold on to that dream. That's one of my big things, is if you have a dream, you have hope. If you have hope, you have something to wake up for. If you have something to wake up for, you're always going to keep going, and you've got something to share and something to give. And that's what music's done for me. It saved me over and over and over again in my life.
Jennifer Bratcher Crafton, a.k.a. Jenny B., speaking with GLT's John Norton. The release party for her debut album, Crickets and Honey, is this Sunday at 4 p.m. at the Schertz Farm in rural Saybrook. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Way, way, way.